day. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to come back to California after spending a winter in the East Coast. Okay, this is working. So I am going to... I know I'm coming after Gilad, so I feel like I have to take you from tango to a more Greek version of dancing. And I always wanted to show that picture from my high school graduation in public. So hopefully I will also convince you that there is some commonalities to these two types of dances other than the relationship to the recently bankrupted countries. So my lab studies the regulation of olfactory receptors. And as you know, mammals can detect an extraordinary number of odorants, somewhere between a trillion and 10, according to which calculations you believe on. And the solution that most species found to deal with this number of odorants is that they evolved an extraordinarily high number of olfactory receptor genes. So in the mouse, there are about 1,500 olfactory receptors. They can be found in every chromosome, in most chromosomes, and they tend to be organized in genomic clusters, as it's shown here, that vary a lot in size and number of olfactory receptors that they contain. Now, when you're interested in the regulation of a gene family, the first thing you're looking at is the promoters of these genes. And olfactory receptor, the promoters of olfactory receptors are very unique and very different from the rest of the mammalian promoters. So here's a plot showing the GC content of all the mammalian promoters, and you can see olfactory receptors are falling in the extreme 80 rich part of the family. So we think this this very high AT content helps distinguish them from all the other genes, and probably is responsible for their restriction in olfactory neurons. However, when we start looking at the promoters, when we start comparing the promoters of olfactory receptors with each other, it's very hard to find differences that would explain the specificity in their expression pattern. Essentially, what we and many others who have done similar computational analysis find is that there's a stereotypic transcription factor binding site for EBF family members near the transcription start site, and then there's repeated motifs for homeobox transcription factors, especially LHX2, which Peter Mombas has shown is required for the expression of most olfactory receptor genes, and maybe EMX2. So this means that every olfactory neuron essentially it has to make a choice between several thousand of at least computationally identical promoters. And although they seem very similar with each other, somehow each neuron makes such a choice that expresses one at extremely high levels and the rest of the repertoire are completely silent. Even the other allele of the same gene is completely silent. And as Hitoshi showed, talked before, the identity, the receptor identity of the neuron plays an instructive role in the glomerulus formation. So it's really important for this choice. This choice really defines the identity of the neuron. So it's important that it's singular and stable for the life of the neuron. Right, so my lab is trying to understand how this process is regulated, and basically what we have found the past 7 years is that we can divide this process in three steps. Silencing happens first, early during the differentiation of olfactory neurons, and this is followed by the selective activation of and desilencing of one olfactory receptor. And then there is a stabilization process that involves a feedback signal that was described genetically by Hitoshi and others several years ago. So I'm going to talk a little bit about each one of these steps. So the silencing happens in the form of a very unusual form of epigenetic silencing that is called constitutive heterochromatin. It's a form of chromatin that in most cell types is restricted to pericentromeric and subtelomeric repeats. But in olfactory neurons, is very abundant on olfactory receptor. Here is a heat map from chromosome 2, depicting the enrichment of one of these repressive histone marks, trimethylation of lysine 9. With red, you can see high levels of this mark, and with green, no enrichment at all. And you can clearly see that the regions, the genomic regions of enrichment for this repressive mark coincides perfectly with the regions of olfactory receptor clusters. So it's a very specific type of silencing that occurs only in the olfactory epithelium, and we don't see it in other cell types. Now, importantly, as I said, it happens early. So it happens during the transition from the stem cell population to the globose basal cells. With FACS sorting experiments, we have determined that even in this very early stage, olfactory receptors are completely silenced. So the silencing occurs before the activation of olfactory receptor transcription. And this linear epigenetic silencing is followed by a very unusual reorganization of the olfactory receptor genes, which, although they are occupying almost every chromosome in the mouse genome, in olfactory neurons they converge in very distinct nuclear fossae. Here is a DNA fish experiment where we use a DNA fish probe that we made a few years ago. And this DNA fish probe can detect all the olfactory receptor alleles at once. And what we found when we did this experiment was this very surprising result. Instead of seeing signal all over the nucleus, we are seeing 4 to 6 foci three to six foci per olfactory neuron. And here is a view of the olfactory epithelium as it differentiates. It's a section of the olfactory epithelium. You can see in the stem cells and the globose basal cells, the signal is very diffuse. There's no organization at all. But as the cells start becoming immature neurons and to commit to the olfactory neuron identity, all these olfactory receptor genes come together in this very unusual foci. Again, this is a very cell type specific structure that we don't see anywhere else. And this foci, we know from many experiments that are a very repressive nuclear structures. This is, for example, X-ray tomography that we've done with Caroline Larabel from Lawrence Berkeley. This is a method where we place olfactory neurons in a capillary, and X-rays go through the capillary, and there's a differential absorption of X-rays based on the concentration of organic material. And when we look at the nuclei of olfactory neurons, we find this very unusual organization where the heterochromatin, the traditional, the presentomeric and subtelomeric repeats are in the center of the nucleus, and you can see they're darker than the active chromatin. But then the periphery of the structure, there's this very, very dark foci that correspond to the olfactory receptor genes. And these are again, regions of chromatin concentration that Caroline has not seen in any other type of nucleus. So essentially, during the differentiation of the olfactory neurons, first they become silenced with this unusual epigenetic mark that is not normally used to regulate genes, and then they come together in this very compact foci that make sure that transcription factors cannot access these genes and keep them completely silent. Okay, so this immediately poses the question, how is olfactory receptor transcription even possible under this structure? And based on experiments we've done, we find that olfactory receptor transcription actually occurs outside of this repressive fossa. Here is a RNA fish experiment where we can detect the nascent RNA transcript, and in every cell that we can detect the transcript, we find that it's separated from the repressive fossa. So there is some active separation between the majority of the olfactory receptors that are in these very dark regions that are not transcriptionally active, and one olfactory receptor allele that somehow escapes and becomes transcribed. And this, of course, is coincides with the removal of these repressive marks selectively from this transcriptionally active allele. Yes?
You cannot see the cluster which is green.
What?
Can you see the cluster of other receptors that belong to the same cluster?
So we haven't been able to do that. That's a very good question. Based on how close they are, the other receptor should be outside also. So there's an additional mechanism that prohibits this activation process from spreading to the neighboring receptors. And as I'll show you in a few slides, is extremely specific. Whatever activates them is restricted to the active allele. So this order of events, the fact that first they become silenced and tethered in this nuclear fossa, and then one becomes desilenced, prompted us to make the hypothesis that part of the activation of olfactory receptor transcription involves the removal of these repressive marks. And that hypothesis helped us to look for proteins that may be involved in this process. And one of the histone demethylases that are known to be able to remove these repressive marks was LSD1. Here is an immunofluorescence experiment in a section of the olfactory epithelium. With red, you can see LSD1, and you can see that the protein is restricted to the more basal parts of the epithelium. And these are cells that are either have not activated receptors, or they are in the process of activating an olfactory receptor. Whereas in the mature olfactory neurons here in green, LSD1 is dramatically downregulated. And we really like this expression pattern, and we focus on this enzyme because we thought that this post-choice repression of LSD1 could be a very elegant way to prohibit activation of additional receptors. So we did some genetic experiments. Jeff Rosenfeld gave us LSD1 conditional knockouts. So when we delete LSD1 before olfactory receptor choice, we basically find that olfactory receptors are not expressed. But if we delete LSD1 after olfactory receptor expression, there is no effects on olfactory receptor transcription or in the targeting of olfactory neurons. So LSD1 is needed just for the initial desilencing and the opening of the locus. And when the olfactory receptor becomes to be transcribed, LSD1 is not needed anymore. And that makes it, together with this expression pattern, makes LSD1 perfect target for this feedback signal that Hitoshi and others described, which we found that is induced by the translation of olfactory receptors in the ER of the olfactory neurons. So our data showed that when an olfactory receptor starts to be translated in the ER, somehow activates the protein kinase PERK, which is a known component of the unfolded protein response. And PERK phosphorylates and activates the translation of ATF5, a transcription factor that is transcribed at extremely high levels in olfactory neurons, but is only translated during the early onset of OR expression. ATF5 goes in the nucleus and leads to the downregulation of LSD1 expression. And we've done genetic experiments where we mutate every single part of this pathway, and what we find in each one of these situations is that in the absence of this feedback pathway, LSD1 expression stays on in the more apical areas where mature neurons should reside. So essentially our data suggests that, as I said, we can divide this process in three different steps. First is silencing, then somehow one receptor gets activated, and then there's a feedback that stabilizes this choice and prevents the activation of additional receptor. However, I feel that these data do not really explain the singularity of the system. I mean, in mutations, either in the silencing or in the feedback signal, we very rarely see olfactory neurons that express more than one olfactory receptor at the very high levels of a wild-type chosen receptor. So we believe that the heart of the singular olfactory receptor choice is somewhere else. So a very talented student in my lab started this project very soon as I started my lab at UCSF, and she basically wanted to find other regulatory sequences that may be involved in olfactory receptor activation, and using a genome-wide epigenetic profiling strategy, And information that we had from the AIDS enhancer that Hitoshi had cloned, which was the first olfactory receptor enhancer described ever, she managed to find a profile of different epigenetic modifications, they don't really matter here, that were very specific for AIDS, and they were also shared by a few other intergenic regions that happened to be in near olfactory receptor clusters. So we found about 50 of these sequences, and we named them after Greek islands. One for nationalistic reasons, two because, as you see in future slides, they are actually, they have characteristics of islands. And we showed that these are enhancers that drive expression in olfactory neurons, and with loss of function experiments, we saw that they are actually, some of them, at least the ones, the few we tested, that when we delete them, the nearby olfactory receptors are not expressed. So they are bona fide olfactory receptor enhancers. So we started since then to further analyze the identity of these sequences. And I just want to briefly introduce a new technique that we're using in the lab that is extremely powerful, and it's called ATAC-seq. And the idea behind it is that you can take nuclei, as few as 500 nuclei, and you can incubate them with a transposase called TN5, and donor DNA that contains Illumina sequencing primers. And essentially, every time the transposase inserts, finds accessible DNA, it will insert this Illumina primers in your genome and will get a piece of DNA cut out. So essentially, with this transposase, you can generate libraries ready for sequencing that represent the accessible part of the nucleus. And you can see an example of how that looks in olfactory neurons. Here are two of these Greek islands that we described before, Crete and Rhodes. And you can see that there is zero signal whatsoever within the borders of the olfactory receptor cluster. But at the exact position of these enhancers, we see very strong signal. And when you get outside of the cluster, you find where the non-olfactory receptor genes reside, you can find very nice accessible regions. So essentially, this shows that in the mixed olfactory receptor population, the only part of the genome that is accessible is that enhancer for this cluster. And the same is true for this. Now, this is nice because it verifies our previous analysis, and essentially all the Greek islands looked like that. But it's also very nice because it allows us to find exact footprints of transcription factor binding sites. So by just changing the way we analyze this data, we can find regions that are protected within the hypersensitive region, and we can ask what is the transcription factor binding site that is enriched in these regions. And surprisingly, what we found was these two transcription factors, EBF and LHX2, which are the same exact transcription factors that we find on the promoters of olfactory receptor genes. So to verify that these are actually bound there, we perform a second type of assay that probably you're more familiar with. It's called chromatin immune precipitation and deep sequencing. Briefly, you cross-link protein-DNA interactions, you immunoprecipitate with a specific antibody, and then you sequence the DNA that comes down. And here is a screenshot of the AIDS enhancer. Here is the ATAC-seq data, the accessibility of this enhancer. And you can see a very, very nice peak for EBF and LHX2. In contrast, olfactory receptor genes are completely devoid of both EBF and LHX2 because the olfactory receptor genes are embedded in this heterochromatin regions. And the same is true for every other enhancer that we looked for. Here is Factiria, one of the enhancers that we analyzed genetically also. You can see both LHX2 and EBF and ATAC-seq. Here is LIPC, same thing. And again, I find extremely remarkable the complete absence of any signal in the olfactory receptor genes. which is in perfect agreement with this data suggesting that they're in this very repressive chromatin structure. And overall, if we look at the whole genome intergenic regions, essentially the Greek islands, all the Greek islands are co-bound by these two transcription factors, and they also have this genetic signature that is important for us, but it shouldn't be relevant to you. So what we did is we, after we did the genome-wide analysis, one way to verify that our antibodies are the correct ones is we take all the peaks and we ask what motif gets enriched in this peak, and with the EBF chip, we find that we get back a perfect EBF binding site. With LHX2 chip, we get a perfect LHX2 binding site, suggesting that there is very high specificity in this analysis. However, if we do the same exact analysis restricted only to the olfactory receptor enhancers, we get something else back. We get this much larger motif that if you pay a little bit attention, you will notice that is composed of an LHX2 binding site and an EBF binding site. And basically in the Greek islands, these two motifs are always together, and they are separated by two nucleotides. This is a very striking enrichment of this composite motif. So here is the enrichment on the Greek islands, very, very high. And for comparison, in the olfactory receptor promoters here in blood, essentially very, very few promoters have this compound motif. It seems to be a signature for the olfactory receptor enhancers. And we, personally, I'm very excited by that because we think that this is a sign of a cooperative DNA binding between these two transcription factors. So we are doing some experiments now in vitro. Some preliminary data suggest that in vitro, indeed, having the two sites so close to each other allows the cooperative binding. We need more work to be certain for that. But if this is true, and this is also happening in vivo, it's very exciting because it explains something that I had real trouble coming to terms with, which is how is it possible that you have these big regions of inaccessible chromatin structure, and yet within these regions you have these two islands where transcription factors can bind. So we think that by creating this composite motif, you allow the cooperative binding of these transcription factors that allows them to maybe remove nucleosomes and allow binding in vivo. So to summarize, what we find is that 43 olfactory receptor clusters, shown in blue here, the majority of olfactory receptor clusters have at least one of these co-bound Greek islands within them. Okay, so it seems that this is a general signature for enhancers that activate olfactory receptor genes. Now there's a problem, though. All these enhancers are essentially regulated by the same two transcription factors that are expressed in every olfactory neuron. So how do you get specificity for the choice of olfactory receptors? Well, the answer is you don't. So we've done now experiments where we compare the accessibility of these enhancers in the total population by sorting OMP-positive cells, or in mature olfactory neurons by sorting neurogenin-positive cells. And we've been able to do this experiment now in very limited populations of cells that express either 1507, MR28, known as MR28, or P2, or olfactory receptor 17. So we can collect only neurons that express a specific receptor, and basically what we find is that if the signature of this enhancer in this very, very pure population is exactly the same or very similar to the signature we see in the mixed population. So essentially, these enhancers are active in every cell regardless of which receptor they express. And one control that is really important is we know that this technique is very good for finding cell type specific modifications, because when we look at the olfactory receptor, so when we sort P2 positive neurons, we find that the P2 allele is accessible, and we see these nice peaks by ATAC-seq. And you can see that the two olfactory receptors left and right that are less than 5 kb apart, they are completely inaccessible. So it's a very, very specific opening of the chromatin structure for this allele. And the reciprocally, if we sort MR28 neurons, we find that the MR28 allele is accessible, but the receptors left and right are not. So it's, this assay works, and it shows that the chromatin structure of the receptors is different depending on whether they are active or not, but the chromatin structure of the enhancers is not. So the enhancer seems to be universal for the olfactory neurons. And this is in agreement also with transgenic reporters we've made, where we find that these enhancers are active in the majority of olfactory neurons. So essentially, I took this problem that says, okay, you have 3,000 identical promoters. How do you choose one? And I just made it a little bit simpler, which is now you have 80 seemingly identical enhancer alleles, and somehow you need to activate only one. So this is very puzzling, and we think that the solution to this problem might be coming from some neat observations we published recently, which has to do with the organization of these enhancers in the nuclei of olfactory receptor. So we've performed this experiment called Hi-C. Essentially what it is that you take chromatin, you cross-link, and you digest with a restriction enzyme, and while things are still cross-linked, you ligate the chromatin, and the pieces that are cross-linked with each other tend to ligate more frequently than pieces that are floating around. And essentially what we do is we take these libraries and we sequence them, and we try to find regions that interact with each other. And when we did that in olfactory neurons, we found that actually olfactory receptors, the Greek islands, tend to interact with each other in much higher frequency than their interactions with any other enhancer in the olfactory neurons. And actually there seems to be some type of specificity. The interactions are not completely random. There are some islands that are more interacting with many other islands. There are islands that are much more specific. And we verified that with DNA FISH experiments, and basically what we find is a very high frequency of colocalization between these enhancer sequences. So in order to test if this is relevant to transcription, we perform a similar experiment like the one that I described using sorted neurons that express MR28. And what we find in this situation is that MR28, when it's transcriptionally active, it interacts with at least 15 different elements from different chromosomes. And we verify that with DNA FISH experiments. And basically what we find is that every time we check neurons at which MR28 is transcriptionally active, one of the two MR28 alleles, shown here in green, interacts with at least two of these enhancers that we found by 4C. And the numbers are quite striking. So it seems to be very specific for the transcriptional state of the neuron. So I will stop with the model we have in mind right now. Of course, it's still a model, but it's a testable model. So we think everything starts with Tango. It takes these two transcription factors that bind cooperatively to this composite motif that is shared between all the enhancers. But this Tango starts evolving, and for reasons that we are still trying to understand, and we have some very exciting preliminary data, these enhancers now start to attract each other. And we think that these enhancers by themselves are very weak, and they are not able to activate transcription at high levels, but when they start recruiting other enhancers, and eventually to recruit a chosen olfactory receptor, a randomly chosen olfactory receptor, then you get into this chimeric formation that can lead to high-level transcription. And because these interactions are rare in general, and because they can only be take place when the olfactory receptors that are linked to these enhancers are aggregated. We think that these enhancer complexes are either unique or extremely rare in the olfactory nucleus. So you might have one or only a few of these regions where olfactory receptor transcription can happen, and we think this is what provides the initial singularity of choice that then is stabilized by this feedback signal. And I'll stop here. I want to thank some amazing graduate students that did most of the work that is published. And Kevin Monahan is a postdoc that came with me at Columbia and is doing all these CHIP-seq and IDEC-seq experiments. Gilad Barnea, who spoke before me, has been a valuable collaborator, and also is Carol Larrabal, who is helping us with X-ray tomography, people who fund us, and of course the two institutions that tolerate me. And thank you very much.
Stavros?
Yeah.
Beautiful as always. One question that I have, since it's a cooperativity of cooperativity, do you have a way to measure the affinities of the different components and to see how it builds up?
Basically, we are setting this whole system in vitro now. We have purified proteins, yeah. So I think that's the only way we can. We need to get KD values,
exactly.
Right? So we are trying to do that.
Excellent.
Yes.
Since all receptors don't seem to be expressed equally, is there any relationship between the receptor position, either near or far from the enhancer?
Yeah, so we found that receptors that are the most proximal to these Greek islands are on average twofold more frequently expressed. So there is some, it's not a very strong, but there is some correlation like that.
Well, gene choice, you know, we used to think that the choice is totally stochastic, but along the dorsal ventral axis, there appear to be a restriction for the particular zone.
Yeah.
So how do you explain this zone specificity, by enhancer or promoter or both?
So I was hoping, so when we analyzed the promoters, we looked, there were about 100 olfactory receptors that we knew the zonal information, and we didn't find any difference in the promoters. Recently, we've got information essentially for more than 1,000 the zonal expression of more than 1,000 olfactory receptors, and by looking at the promoters, we still don't find anything that it's mind-boggling. I was hoping the enhancers would give us this information, but they clearly don't. I mean, we've looked at many transients, and they don't have an they don't have dorsoventral differences. We've compared different zones for the accessibility of these enhancers, and there's no difference whatsoever. There are two things that we are thinking right now. One is that maybe the zonality is not conferred by the possibility of choice, but by the ability to stabilize the signal. So because we know that olfactory receptors induce the UPR, and we know that the UPR needs to be terminated, we think that maybe there are some type of specialized chaperones that are expressed in a zonal fashion, in addition to the general ones, and that if you are chosen in an area where you can be then targeted in an efficient way and turn off the unfolded protein response, then the feedback will kick in early and will stabilize this choice. So it could be a post-choice stabilization in a zonal fashion. That's one idea. The other idea is that there are some other more genomic-related information that affects the distribution of these genes in the three-dimensional structure depending on their zone. So we're doing now some experiments to ask if we find that olfactory receptors that are expressed in the same zone, do they tend to interact with each other and form a subcomplex in the nucleus that is separating from the rest, some type of genomic organization that is not by the promoter or the enhancer, but maybe the codic sequence, or maybe just the genomic region that they are. But I agree, this is a question that we are not even close to answering. I know there's no different transcription factors between P2 and MR28 that would explain that. So it's something else.
I was wondering if you know anything about the biochemical and structural organization of these inaccessible clusters and how they relate to these big blobs of heterochromatin in the nucleus.
What do you mean by chemical?
What's in
the proteins in there? So we know that there's HP1 beta, which is a heterochromatin binding protein that has been described in other heterochromatic regions. And when we knock out HP1 beta, they become much more accessible. There's also a unique component that we have found is called NCAPZ2, which is a component of the condensing complex that condenses chromosomes during mitosis. And it's very highly expressed in olfactory neurons, and we find it on these regions. We have a knockout, and we don't know yet if there is something going on with that. But it would make a lot of sense if you have something more specific binding to this. But yeah, we're trying we are developing methods to isolate them and do mass spec and see what else is there, because there must be something different from the rest of the heterochromatin. Yes.
So Stavros, so for your model to work, the OR cluster that's been sequestered and condensed has to leave the promoter outside, right? So a thought experiment would be that if you move that to closer to the OR cluster, would that affect the gene expression pattern?
To move it closer to what?
To move towards the OR that the cluster itself, because the enhancer is still far away from it.
Right. So I think that's why ORs that are closer to the so these enhancers are predominantly outside of the big foci. So probably the ORs that are nearby, just by association, they tend to be excluded more often. Now, Hitoshi had done this experiment a long time ago where he put the H enhancer next to a promoter, and you get expression very, very frequently. So I bet that this is related to that.
What about the ones that are not in cis, but in trans? Would you expect to affect the... So if you move the enhancer away from this region, and it gets condensed into the cluster, would that affect in trans other gene expression?
It's hard to tell, because my model and our model in the lab is that you need to have a cis enhancer in order to get out and to be activated. But you need to have other trans enhancer to get high levels of transcription. So if you don't have a cis enhancer, it would be very unlikely that you go into that complex, right? So that, I guess we can force it with different ways, yeah.
So during this development, the multiple receptors initially expressed and then restricted into one, or one was initially chosen and then stabilized?
I don't know, but I would bet yes.
Yes, for what?
For multiple ones being initially... So I don't think the initial desilencing is the singular process. I would imagine that you have 5 or 10 desilenced and transcribed at low levels, and only if you happen to assemble this enhancer complex, which is much more rare, this one will produce enough transcript to elicit the UPR, and right? So my feeling is that when people start doing single-cell RNA-seq and looking at the different stages, they will find that in the progenitor cells, there will be transcript for more than one that later gets pruned. Yeah.
So I will venture a very naive question, so this is getting late here. Is there anything to be gained by looking at different species and just doing data mining, looking at the OR clusters, and if there's some way of looking at sort of expression levels of different receptors?
Yes.
And then,
one experiment we are thinking very seriously of doing is, and we start thinking about it when I was still in San Francisco, there's this little island called complex called the Farallon Islands, which is 2 or 3 hours from San Francisco, and it's infested by mice that came in with the first explorers in the early 1700s or whenever that was. And there's a huge colony that has been completely secluded. They don't have any predators there. It's a very diversified type of mice. And somebody in North Carolina has made the colony of that. So we want to take these mice, compare the transcriptome, see what if different receptors now are expressed at different frequencies, and go look at these enhancers and see if there are SNPs that explain that. But I think that's a very good approach. It requires a lot of money, but it will be very fun to do that experiment.
Okay, thank all the speakers one last time. And break for lunch.